Fletch 2 by Gregory MacDonald. Copyright 1986 by the author. This recording of the reading of Fletch 2 was published by arrangement with Gregory MacDonald and was produced in 1988 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. Please observe the following procedures as you listen to these tapes. If you have borrowed this book from your local library, please return it to them at the end of the agreed period. If you are one of our regular rental customers, you may keep your book for 30 days from date of receipt by you, but after that time, we charge additional rental of 25 cents per day. Dates are checked by postmark. Please return this book at the earliest possible time so another subscriber can have the use of this recording. To return cassettes to us, simply make sure they are all packaged in their plastic cassette cases and in proper order in the mailing container. Kindly seal the mailing container for return. Postage is already paid. Drop in any mailbox for return to Books on Tape. Unless you are at home during the day, you will probably find it more convenient to have tapes mailed to you at your business address rather than your home. Reason is that postmen cannot leave packages if no one is there to receive them. Should a cassette fail to play properly, hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, or if you cannot otherwise free the reels, and if you are a library customer, please ask your local library to contact Books on Tape for a replacement cassette. If you are one of our rental customers, please call us at our regular customer service number. Give us the name of the book and number of the cassette. We will immediately send you a replacement at no charge. Discard the broken cassette. Fletch 2 by Gregory MacDonald. This book consists of 42 chapters and is 249 pages long. Dedication. Dedicated to the Wenanche, also dedicated to Joyce and Arthur Green, with special thanks to Kathy Eldon and Alexei Bragin. Chapter 1. What astounded Fletch was that the letter written to him was signed Fletch. Chapter 2. Do you, Erwin Morris Fletcher, promise to love, honor, serve, and support in all ways a man can support a woman? The preacher shouted. Down the bluff, the wind was whipping up whitecaps on the Pacific Ocean. A curtain of hard rain was visible a couple of miles offshore. Cherish, respect, encourage, relinquish all interests and endeavors which do not serve the marriage, until death do you part? Who wrote this? Fletch asked. At his side, wind whipping her skirt, Barbara said, I did. You never gave me a chance to discuss it with you. Let's discuss it now. Behind them on the bluff overlooking the sea stood their wedding guests, coat collars up, holding onto their hats. Be a good sport, Barbara said. Say you do. We'll have plenty of time to discuss it. That's what I'm afraid of. Barbara said to the preacher, He says I do. The preacher looked at Fletch. Do you do? I guess I do. And do you, Barbara Ralston, promise to be a wife to this man to the best of your abilities? I do. The preacher then began to read interminably from some word processor printout. Some rabbits built their hutch in a dell. Spring rains came, and the hutch got flooded out. They built a new hutch in a high place. The winds knocked it over. Watching the storm approaching from the sea, Fletch suspected the wedding party was going to get flooded out and blown over, too. The wedding had been planned for 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon. Fletch had gotten all his copy in by 2 o'clock, shaved in the men's room at the newspaper, and had reached his wedding at 2:40. Surprised to see you here, Fletch said to Frank Jaffe, the editor of the News Tribune. Thought you pretend employees don't exist Saturdays. I've been standing in for you at various police stations and courts the last 3 days, Frank said. Thought I might have to stand in for you today at your wedding, too. You almost did. Two pickup trucks with their tailgates down were parked across the field. In the bed of one truck, delicatessen food was laid out. In the bed of the other, plastic glasses, liquor, and ice. Are all the various charges against me dropped? Can I get through an airport without being arrested? Frank tasted his drink. Good follow-up on that lawyer's murder in this morning's edition. Got the big Sunday wrap-up in for tomorrow? Yes, Frank. How about the big expose of Ben Franklin for tomorrow? Ben Franklin will be exposed in Sunday's newspaper, Frank. Pages and pages of it, with pictures. You've been working day and night since Monday.
Very nearly.
You look half asleep.
Frank.
Have a nice honeymoon, Frank smiled. You need the rest.
Alston Chambers said, Fletch, thanks for coming. Being best man in a wedding without a groom is becoming a real strain.
If you come across any hot stories on your honeymoon, Frank said, be sure and phone them in. We may have found your talent in investigative reporting.
Alston looked down at Fletch's jeans and sneakers.
Didn't have time to change, huh? Alston, I'm here, I'm shaved, I'm employed, I get to go on a honeymoon. I mean avalanches, mudslides.
Frank finished his drink.
Major earthquakes, airplane crashes, train wrecks.
Alston said, I left some clothes for you at the city desk. Didn't they tell you?
No. Frank continued, mass murders, acts of terrorism, like, you know, airport bombings.
Alston took Fletch by the elbow.
Your bride, having noticed you're here, would like you to go over and stand next to her in front of the preacher. That's integral to the wedding.
Be sure and phone in, Frank said, if you get any good stuff.
Fletch said to his mother, I'm surprised to see you here.
A long-stemmed flower bobbing from her hat hit Fletch in the eye as Josephine Fletcher leaned forward to kiss her son.
I wouldn't miss your first wedding for anything.
This is the only wedding I have planned, Fletch said. She waved airily.
After this, you're on your own.
After this? Josie scanned his clothes.
I guess you're dressed appropriately for a picnic next to the sea.
She was dressed in watered silk.
I've been working.
Barbara's mother was quite certain you wouldn't show up at all. She says you never do.
Where is she? I've never met the lady.
So she says. She's the one over there in Jodhpur's.
Of course.
Josie scanned the bush.
I don't see where she parked your elephant.
Elephant?
Cindy took Fletch's other elbow.
The preacher says if you don't get over there, all hell will break loose.
Fletch turned and shook her hand.
Can't thank you enough, Cindy, for everything. You've helped Barbara get ready for our skiing honeymoon. You've helped me keep my job.
Cindy took the hand of a young woman standing next to her.
I feel this is as much our wedding as yours.
It is.
Fletch shook the hand of the other woman.
Have a nice life.
Fletch, Alston said, looking harried, this person says she has to meet you right now. Her name is Linda.
I don't suppose this is a very good time to tell you this.
Linda pulled his shirt out of his jeans. She cupped the palms of her hands against the skin of his waist.
I'm in love with you.
You've never seen me before.
I see you now. This is it for me. Wildly, passionately in love.
Her eyes said she was serious.
Alston, how much are you paying this person?
Alston sighed.
Fletch said to Linda, I'm just about to get married.
Really?
Sticking her chin out, she slid her hands up his sides.
That's why we're all here, Fletch said.
The wind was beginning to come up. Standing around in this horrible place...
Alston said, I think weddings make some people romantic.
Linda asked,
when are you returning from your honeymoon?
2 weeks. We're going skiing in Colorado.
Don't break anything, she said.
I'll try not to.
Because I'm going to be your next wife.
You are?
I've decided that.
Linda looked like what she was saying was entirely reasonable.
In fact, you might as well skip this wedding with Barbara altogether.
Boy, Alston said, getting you married is something I'll never try again.
Was she serious? Call me when you get back, Linda said. I work with Barbara.
Oh, nice.
Fletch was being guided strongly by the elbow across the field. Actually, she is beautiful.
Barbara? Alston asked.
Fletch said,
Linda.
Oh, boy.
The wind had come up enough, so Fletch had to speak loudly to the woman in Jodhpur's.
Hello, Barbara's mother. How are you?
The woman looked at him as if accosted.
Who are you?
Fletch tucked in his shirt.
Don't worry, you're not gaining a son.
Oh, my God.
Nice to meet you, too. In front of the preacher, Fletch pinched Barbara's bottom. She wriggled. Nice you could make the time. Hey, I filed 2 terrific stories this week. He shook hands with the preacher. To one side stood a man Fletch did not recognize. Standing alone, he was watching, not socializing. Middle-aged, he wore khaki trousers, khaki shirt, blue necktie, and a zippered leather jacket. His eyes were light blue. He held a sealed manila envelope. Fletch said, I just got a marriage proposal. Are you seriously considering it? Barbara asked. The bride wore walking shoes, leg warmers collapsed around her calves, skirt and sweater. She carried a bouquet of flowers. Fletch said, nice posies. They're forget-me-nots. Alston remembered them. Fletch looked across the field at the pickup trucks. Someone arranged for caterers, too. Alston. Fletch looked at Alston. Guess I picked the right best man. Alston shrugged. Didn't have anything else to do. I'm an unemployed lawyer. And, Barbara said, Alston has packed up all your skiing things and brought them to the airport and checked them in. Fletch looked at Cindy. I'm getting chewed out here. Without Alston and Cindy, Barbara's voice trailed off in the wind. Alston touched the preacher's arm as if searching for a starter button. Sir? The preacher smiled. I've learned to wait until the bride and groom stop arguing. It makes for a nicer ceremony. Alston said, the weather. The preacher looked out to sea. Ominous. The end of the allegory regarding rabbits was entirely blown away in the wind, despite the preacher's shouting. Fletch wondered if he would ever know where the rabbits finally set up hutch. The wind abated enough so that the preacher could be heard to yell, With the powers invested in me by the state of California, I now declare you man and wife. What God has put together, let no man put asunder. A heavy raindrop fell on Fletch's nose. Immediately, Linda broke between the bride and groom and kissed the groom on the mouth. What about woman? Fletch tried to say. Cindy was kissing Barbara. Hand on the back of his neck, Linda said, Next time, baby, you and me. The preacher was kissing Barbara. Alston shook Fletch's hand. I do divorces. My vows seemed longer than her vows. I'm sure it always seems that way. Barbara's mother was kissing Barbara. The middle-aged man dressed in khaki came through the crowd. He handed Fletch the envelope. Thanks, Fletch said. Immediately, there were splotches of rain on the envelope. Alston was kissing Barbara. In the envelope were 2 passports, 2 thick airline ticket folders, a wad of bills, and a letter. Fletch said, Barbara? Frank Jaffe was kissing Barbara. The man in khaki already was up on the road getting into a sports car. He had said nothing. Barbara? Dear Irwin, what a moniker your mother hung on you. As soon as I heard that was who you were to be, Irwin Morris, I said to myself, there's nothing I can do for him. With a name like that, either he'll be a champ or a dolt. Which is it? I'm mildly curious. After having missed out on your whole life, I didn't want to break a perfect record by attending your wedding. How curious are you? Enclosed is a wedding present, which you may take any way you want. You may take the money, cash in the tickets, and buy your bride a nice set of china or something. That's probably what I would do. Or if you're mildly curious about me, you and your bride can come visit me in my natural habitat. Squandering money is always fun, too. Seeing you've now put yourself in the way of being a father yourself, at least you've gotten married, I thought we could meet agreeably. If you do come to Nairobi, I've made a reservation for you and Barbara at the Norfolk Hotel. Maybe I'll see you there. Fletch. The rain was making the ink run on the page. Barbara! It was raining hard. Across the field, people were dashing for their cars. As Josephine walked, the flower blossom from her hat bobbed in front of her face. Men were throwing tarpaulins over the beds of the pickup trucks. What's that? Alston asked. $100 bills were fluttering out of Fletch's hand and blowing in the wind. Alston scurried around picking them up. On the road, Barbara was getting into a car with her mother. Where's Nairobi? Fletch handed Alston the dripping letter. Nairobi? East Africa? Kenya? Reading the letter, Alston tried to protect it from the wind and the rain with his body.
Fletch, your father!
On the road, cars were going off in each direction. Josephine Fletcher was nowhere in sight. Even the pickup trucks went in different directions.
Fletch, this has to be from your father. You always said he was dead.
He always was dead. Together, they looked at the faint lines under the running ink of the writing paper.
What the hell, Alston said. Your plane for Denver leaves at 6 o'clock.
Peering inside the envelope, Fletch said, these tickets are for a plane to London leaving at 7:30. Only a few cars were left on the road.
Alston, where's my mother staying?
At the Hanley Motor Court, on Caldwell, just off the freeway north.
Do you suppose that's where she's gone?
Of course, Alston shivered. We're soaking wet.
Oh, yeah.
Fletch took the illegible letter from Alston and stuffed it back in the envelope. If you see Barbara, tell her I'll meet her at the airport.
Where are you going?
Rain ran down the faces of the two young men as they looked at each other. Jogging up the slope to his car, Fletch slipped and fell. He landed on the envelope in the mud.
Chapter 3. Your father died in childbirth.
Whose?
Yours.
They stood inside the door of Josephine Fletcher's room at the Hanley Motor Court. She had changed into slacks, blouse, and open sweater. He was dripping wet. He clutched the muddy envelope to his side.
That's what you've always said. You need a hot shower.
You've always said that, too.
Mostly for you, I've recommended cold showers.
Josie turned on the light in the bathroom.
You're muddy, soaked, disheveled, and, my son, you look more exhausted than Hillary at the top of Mount Everest. What have you been doing to yourself?
Working, getting married, normal things.
They don't seem to agree with you, but I will correct myself. For that particular wedding, you were indeed dressed appropriately. If I had known what was to happen, I would have worn a swimsuit.
Your silk dress got watered.
Josie crossed the room to him. She put her hand out for the envelope under his arm. Do you think you had some communication from your father on your wedding day?
Yes, I think so. He put the muddy envelope on the bureau.
That would be interesting, Josie said. Exciting, to both of us. First, let me ask you, is your wedding over?
Not the marriage.
That was it? So much milling about and shouting on a stormy bluff over the ocean?
We didn't have a backup plan.
Only an hour ago, you married a nice girl named Barbara, Josie said patiently. You have, or you think you have, some communication from beyond the grave. However interesting and exciting it might be, possibly, to hear from your father, don't you think this is one of those particularly special times you really ought to be with your wife, no matter what?
She'll understand.
Don't be too sure, sonny.
Josie's face saddened. She turned toward the rain-streaked window.
Love and understanding have nothing to do with each other. I loved your father. I did not understand him.
Why not?
Was he too masculine and I too feminine? Maybe the modern expectation that men and women really can understand each other is so false that it destroys marriages. As a woman, however, I will report to you that having a man present in a marriage means rather a lot to a woman.
She turned to Fletcher again.
Like on your wedding day and other notable occasions.
Fletch put his finger on the envelope.
This appears to be from my father. You've always given me the stupid line, your father died in childbirth. Never anything more, no matter how much I've asked. I've always let you have the literary conceit of this stupid line, but the humor of it is worn as thin as my skin at the moment.
You're curious?
Fletch took a deep breath.
Mildly.
What I'm saying, sonny, is that I see your possibly hearing from your father causes you to do exactly as he would have done.
What's that?
Leave your bride alone on your wedding day.
Did he do that to you?
He spent the entire wedding reception at the other end of the hangar removing, repairing, and replacing the engine in the airplane we were about to use for our honeymoon.
You were married in an airplane hangar?
By now you know how wind and rain on a bluff exposed to the sea can drown out the sweetest words a woman should ever hear. Consider how much of the wedding ceremony is heard in an airport aluminum hangar with 30 seconds between scheduled takeoffs and landings.
Fletch smiled. Are you sure you were married? Are you sure you were married? He wanted to be sure of the engine before he took his bride up in the plane. That was my kind thought, too, back when I expected to understand because I loved. What do you think now? I think he was avoiding the reception, the congratulations, the handshakes, the slaps on the back, the jokes, and the reasonable questions obliging him to speak of our future with responsibility. Her eyes narrowed. What are you doing? My editor, Frank Jaffe, says I may have a talent for investigative reporting. This is your wedding day. Fletch shrugged. I've spent most of it working. Why is it considered the height of masculinity for a man to avoid the biggest emotional moments of his life by burying his head and his body in work? Trick cyclists say a man's urge to work is as great as his sexual urge. She smiled. I haven't heard that slang for the mental health brigade in decades. I read that lately. Wouldn't you say work can also be man's way of avoiding emotional responsibility? Okay, super, you should know. But you're not going to evade my question now. Josephine Fletcher colored. She said, Your mild curiosity, the mystery about your father, is not worth your taking 2 minutes from your wedding day. Fletch shivered. I don't know that for a fact. Get into the shower, his mother said. Barbara won't want you sneezing all over her during your honeymoon. This traveler's court, or whatever it is, must have a washer-dryer for those Americans who choose to live all their lives entirely behind windshields. There are towels in the bathroom. When he handed his clothes to her through the bathroom door, she said, You know, I'm mildly curious, too. Would you show me what you think you got from your father? Wrapped in a towel, he crossed the room to the envelope. Some tickets to Nairobi, Kenya, and some cash and a letter. Yes, she said, if he's alive, he probably would be in Africa. I thought that. May I see the letter? Between index finger and thumb, Fletch pulled the drenched, blued piece of paper out of the envelope and handed it to her. Josie held it in two hands. As she looked at the washed-out blank page, her face crinkled. Oh, Irwin, don't you see? There's nothing there. Chapter 4 Ironic and rather sad that you are spending your wedding day with your mother. Josie had ordered lunch for them from room service. They sat at odd angles, obliged by the smallness of the motel room at the round table, taking the toothpicks out of their club sandwiches. Wind slashed rain against the window. I say, more in worry than in bitterness, see what your father has wrought. First time you ever hear from him, and you respond with behavior unnatural but typical of him. That much I've heard. When Fletch bit into his sandwich, a dollop of mayonnaise landed on the towel below his waist. Can't you at least telephone Barbara? Not sure where she is. You just told me you're an investigative reporter. Surely you can find her. I've told Alston, my best man, to tell her I'd meet her at the airport. What does that mean? Josie's bite of her sandwich was so small, mayonnaise had no chance to escape her. I want to do some thinking. Her eyes widened. You're not honestly thinking of going to Nairobi. He shrugged. When will we ever get the chance? Oh, Irwin, this man ignores you all your life. We presume him dead, and suddenly he snaps his fingers and you cancel your honeymoon and fly halfway around the world to meet him. It could be a honeymoon. Barbara might like it. Fletch remembered. Growing up, he had not been exactly the center of Josie Fletcher's universe either. There were her detective novels, always. He called them her defective novels. Because none had sold particularly well, there had had to be a lot of them. Other people made jokes about his mother's books. She had not written many novels, people said. She had written one novel many times. People joked that her publisher kept her writing one novel until she got it right. True, her producing murder and mayhem for quiet libraries throughout the land had kept them reasonably sheltered and reasonably fed. For that, he was grateful to her. Josie Fletcher lived in a world in which fictional characters had reality and real people were forgotten, blinked at, treated vaguely. The characters in her novels seldom had breakfast, lunch, and dinner all in the same day, never had cuts in their elbows, black eyes, broken fingers, itchy pubic hairs, or teachers deeply mistaken in their students' mathematical potential. They never went shopping to replace trousers that had risen up the shank of the leg or split in the back when the wearer stooped for a drink from the school water bubbler. Independence was not something for which Fletch had ever had to strive. There had been moments when he had deeply resented it. Yet here he was on his wedding day in a moldy motel room, having a sandwich with his mother, listening to her surprise at his expressing mild curiosity regarding his father. She had never, never told him about their marriage. In fact, he was curious about both of them, always had been. "Why haven't you?" he asked.
"Why haven't I what?"
"Ever told me about my father, your marriage?" "Fear and fairness."
"Fear?"
"Your masculinity, too, my son, is something I've never been able to come to grips with. Don't think a mother doesn't know. You've been ripping your jeans on garden fences since you were 9 years old."
In front of his mother, Fletch blushed. "Men aren't born virgins, you know."
"You weren't, at any rate."
"A man has nothing to give up but his energy," Fletch laughed.
"Oh, God."
"I can't help it if I'm energetic."
"Is that what you call it?
May I have some of your French fries?"
"Of course. Do keep up your energy."
"I had pizza about 3 this morning. Supper, breakfast, I don't know which."
"Despite all my last chapters, not all mysteries have solutions. How does a mother explain to a son that she doesn't understand a husband, a father, that she was in a marital situation she doesn't understand?"
"By beginning with chapter 1.
And there's the element of fairness. I could have spewed forth what I thought about your father, my confusion, my hurt, my puzzlement, the mystery. But he wasn't around, you see, to defend himself, to give you his side of whatever story. I loved him, you see."
"You could have told me he left you, not that he died, for Christ's sake."
"I never knew that, you see."
Her face turned whiter.
"You show up today with, frankly, a blank piece of paper."
Fletch watched his mother try to gather together in one hand another quarter of her 3-decker sandwich.
"You know that we had to have your father declared assumed dead after 7 years. Otherwise, I couldn't have married Charles."
"I remember him."
"He wasn't with us long, was he?"
"Or Thad."
"You've kept the name Fletcher."
"Well, I'd published books under that name, you see, and it was your name, and Charles and Thad and... weren't your father."
She wiped under her eyes with her paper napkin.
"It was the impossibleness of your father that I loved. If that blank piece of paper you showed me means anything, if he did go somewhere, I would have loved to have gone with him."
"But you say you didn't understand him."
"Oh, who the hell understands anybody? Damn fools keep asking me why I write mystery stories. Maybe because there's a big mystery in my life I've never been able to solve. So, neurotically, I keep setting up simulated mysteries and arriving at simulated solutions. Frustrated practicing."
"Writers have an uncontrollable compulsion to control compulsion," Fletch said.
"I read that somewhere, too. Remembered it in my effort to understand you."
"Lots of luck," she said.
"Chapter 1. Fletch snuck a look at her wristwatch. "I'm trying to make a decision here. Am I flying to Denver, Colorado, or Nairobi, Kenya?"
"I don't know what to tell you."
"Chapter 1, he repeated.
"Chapter 1, she said. "High school, Montana. I was the pretty little thing, cheerleader, honor student."
"I've read this book," Fletch said, "several times. And he was the big man on campus, president of the class, captain of the football team."
"Far from it. He was way out."
"Sorry, wrong novel."
"Way out, skidding his overpowered motorcycle around his parents' dirt poor ranch. Bright enough. He once wrote this paper for an English class, this long, somber, brilliant analysis of a Shakespearean sonnet. The teacher gave him an A+ and complimented Walter in class. Walter roared with laughter. He told everybody he had written the Shakespearean sonnet himself and then analyzed it. Nearly destroyed the teacher."
"Ah," said Fletch, "so it was Daddy who wrote Shakespeare."